This month's installment of The F-Word is all about the migration crisis and the root of that crisis in imperialist wars, plunder, and destruction. Also, anti-war activists supporting the Iran nuclear deal celebrate a victory. And there are actions this week to end the blockade on Cuba. All that and more coming up next. And welcome to Thursday's Community Watch and Comment. This is the on-the-ground edition for September 17, 2015 on 89.3 WPFW, Pacifica's listener-powered station for jazz and justice in the nation's capital. On the ground and onthegroundshow.org are devoted to coverage of social justice activists and activism on the streets and in the suites of power. We cover here in the DMV, the nation, and around the planet. I'm Esther Averm, and I'm joined in the studio by my engineer, Mike Nasella, and also our contributor, Chantel James, who we'll speak to later in the show. Today, we're going to go to DuPont Circle here in Northwest D.C. to hear voices at a rush hour rally that turned out to be a victory celebration for those supporting the Iran nuclear deal. And later, we'll be talking about the migrant crisis in Europe and in this hemisphere with Professor Gerald Horn and activist Arturo Vizcarra for this month's installment of The F-Word. As always, we have a lot for you in this less than an hour, but we'll start with our headlines. DC Sun, one of the organizations that defeated Exelon's bid to take over Pepco, is urging the public to attend a rally, which starts in about an hour for today's meeting of the DC Public Service Commission. That action will be in front of the Wilson Building at 1350 Pennsylvania Avenue. The goal of the action is to tell Mayor Bowser and the DC Council to stand their ground against Chicago-based energy giant Exelon as it tries to breathe new life into its nearly dead bid to take over Pepco. Last month, D.C. scored a big victory when the Public Service Commission unanimously rejected Exelon's attempt to take over Pepco. Their decision made it clear that this merger is not in the public interest. But D.C. Sun says that the fight is not quite over. They don't want Exelon to reach a backroom deal with the mayor or council. So that's today at noon. Join them in front of the Wilson Building at 1350 Pennsylvania Avenue. The first of three actions against the Cuban blockade was held here in Washington, D.C. last night at the Florida Avenue Baptist Church. The meeting was sponsored by Pastors for Peace and the Washington Peace Center after a day of advocating for Cuba on Capitol Hill. Gail Walker, executive director of Pastors for Peace, told the gathering that even though diplomatic relations have been normalized between Cuba and the United States, that activists need to continue to demand ending of the economic blockade of the Caribbean nation and the freedom to travel there.
We know that there have been some gains made in the area of travel, but I say that with reservation, right? Because as you know, many of us who have been doing travel challenges have refused to accept the license to travel to Cuba. And we've done so on principle. We've said that the acceptance of a license is a de facto acceptance of a policy of hatred, of genocide, of murder against the people of Cuba. And we recognize that even the categories that have now been allowed to travel more easily to Cuba, these 12 categories that were presented by President Obama is a step toward at least, you know, recognizing that we have a right to travel to Cuba without accepting a license, without applying for a license. And that's the goal. So we don't want to look a dip horse in the mouth. We want to be able to sort of recognize those baby steps, but it's certainly not enough. And we need to continue to push and push and push until we are able to all travel to Cuba freely without asking permission to travel and be in solidarity with our brothers and sisters there, no matter where that might be in the island, whether it's fellowshipping with them in the church service, whether it's meeting them on the monopone, whether it's traveling with them to a baseball game. Whatever the case may be, that is a right that we as citizens of the world have and will continue to fight to make that accomplishment.
The activities to support the Cuban people and to end the Cuban blockade will continue through tomorrow. And these events are sponsored by Pastors for Peace and the Washington Peace Center. And finally, in our culture and media moment, in D.C., Black Panther's Vanguard of the Revolution is opening Friday at the East Street Cinema here in D.C. and at the Charles Theater in Baltimore. And those who pledge to get tickets during our fundraiser, your names will be at the door starting on Friday. And those are our headlines and happenings. When we come back, voices for the Iran nuclear deal and against another war in the Middle East. Stay with us. Recently, activists have shown that we can fight for social justice and win against PEPCO and last week against all those who would like to beat the drums of war to continue to attack Iran. Well, today we're going to go to DuPont Circle here in Northwest D.C. to voices at a rush hour rally sponsored by MoveOn.org that turned out to be a victory celebration for those supporting the Iran nuclear deal.
Stop another war.
So a number of us today, we're here, have indeed fought in the United States military and are now speaking out to stop another war. We have two speakers in particular who are veterans who I'd like to welcome. Jonathan Hugo is the first. Would you please join us? Thank you for your service. Thank you for being here.
What's happening? Appreciate you.
Thank you.
All right.
Money for jobs.
Not for war.
Yes.
Money for jobs.
Not for war.
Money for health care.
Not for war.
Money for school.
Not for war.
Money for people.
Not for war.
Money for humanity.
Not for war.
Thank you, MoveOn.org. Thank you all to peace and justice and social justice activists that are gathered here today. I became a dedicated Trump trooper for MoveOn. About 9 years ago, I was stationed in Virginia as an active duty seaman. You all may remember, I know this lady right here. You all remember a senator named George Allen introduced the term McCaughlin to our consciousness and moved in. And I'm glad you did. You actually forced me to register to vote in the state of Virginia. This is a victory today. It's a beautiful day. It's a glorious day, but we know the struggle does not stop here today. We look back at what happened a decade plus ago, and we know for a fact that diplomacy is better than death. We know that inspectors on the ground is much better than boots on the ground. We know that weapons inspectors can do what boots on the ground cannot do. We're here to say that peace is the best roadmap to a better humanity. Give peace a chance. What if Hans Blitz had been given a chance? And his inspectors. I cringe every time I see the picture of Colin Powell making that case, holding that little bottle, making that case for that preemptive war in Iraq. We look at the thousands of American soldiers and airmen killed, the tens of thousands that maimed, the hundreds and hundreds of thousands of Iraqis. Have we not learned the lessons? So we come forth here today to say that today was a victory, but we know it's going to take a lot more work for us to really say to our country that this is what America is about. We are a country that believes in international law. We stand the most to gain from it. We should support human rights. We believe in that. We should support self-determination. We're built on that. Give peace a chance.
Thank you.
Give peace a chance.
Give peace a chance. Give peace a chance. Give peace a chance.
Louder.
Give peace a chance. Move on forward, don't go back. Don't let Iran be the next Iraq. Move on forward, don't go back. Don't let Iran be the next Iraq.
All right.
All right, all right.
Thank you for that introduction. My name is James Salt. I am with Catholics United for the Common Good. We are united with Pope Francis, the American Catholic Bishops, the Women Religious Leaders and Network, and virtually every Catholic organization across America in supporting diplomacy, not war. I'm honored to be here, specifically sharing this speaking opportunity with Phyllis Bennis and Sister Marge Clark. You know, every time Phyllis Bennis speaks, I learn something important. Every time Sister Marge speaks, she's been leading this movement. The network sisters have been leading the social justice movement for years, and we are honored to be here with you. Thank you. I'm also happy to be here with Move On members. It was a Move On digital primary campaign that led me to give my first political donation in 2004. You, the members of Move On, have been the leaders of the progressive change movement for decades, and I am grateful for you letting me be here. Like many of us here today, I feel like a survivor of 9/11. I was in Manhattan on that fateful day. I heard the planes fly over. We smelt the sulfur for months afterwards. And I'm not sure what was more psychologically scarring. Those terrorist attacks or the way our nation responded to it. It seems like over the last 15 years, we've only known war. Now, on the brink of a diplomatic agreement with Iran, I feel like our nation is turning a corner. Instead of reverting to that first impulse of attack, we are sitting down and talking, negotiating, using diplomacy as a first step towards resolving our conflicts. It feels like our nation is healing. I don't say this lightly. We're also here in DuPont Circle. I remember Tom Matthews and Claire Roach organizing a memorial service for the passing of Ted Kennedy. I'd like to recall Ted Kennedy when he said his vote against the use of force in Iraq was the single most important vote of his career in Congress. And this is a lion of the Senate with an immense list of legislative accomplishments. I think if Ted Kennedy were with us here today, he'd say the second most consequential vote of his lifetime would be voting for diplomacy with Iran. I believe the stakes surrounding this vote are that serious. But our work is not yet done. Our team working on the Hill have informed me that Senator Cardin has drafted legislation that would potentially destabilize this agreement, specifically by introducing military hardware to the region, specifically bunker-busting bombs and the planes that can deliver them. That is an end-around strategy right now to destabilize this agreement. I've heard military experts and nuclear experts agree that that is cause for violation of this agreement if it's passed. Today is a great victory. We have a lot more work to do. The path towards peace is long. The first step is often the hardest. Let's keep moving. I ask that you join me in working to protect this historic opportunity that we are in the midst of. Thank you. Now I'd like to close with a short prayer. Short prayer. This is the prayer of St. Francis, which reminds me that Pope Francis is coming to the mall September 24th. Heather and a team of us are organizing the rally in support of climate justice. Come out and support us. 7 a.m., Pope speaks at 9. We're going to rally for climate justice on the mall. Obama made it a work from home day. Come out and join us for the morning with Pope Francis. The prayer of St. Francis. Lord, make me an instrument of your peace. Where there is hatred, let me sow love. Where there is injury, pardon. Where there is doubt, faith. where there is despair, hope, where there is darkness, light, where there is sadness, joy. O divine master, grant that I may not so much seek to be consoled as to console, to be understood as to understand, to be loved as is to love. For it is in giving that we receive, it is in pardoning that we are pardoned, and it is in dying that we are born to eternal life. Amen.
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 So, our next speaker is Diane Randall, Executive Secretary of the Free Community on National Legislation.
Everyone, thank you for being here today, and thank you for all your hard work. You guys have been incredible. Let me say this. I work with the Friends Committee on National Legislation. We are a Quaker lobby organization based on Capitol Hill. Yep, and I am so proud of our staff, our Kate Gould, who is here, who's been, if you didn't see the story about her in CQ, she's a Quaker lobbyist who's a hardworking person for peace. Here's the deal. Every person here has their own story of why you work for peace. My story is I started working with the Nuclear Freeze Campaign when I became a mother. And I realized I didn't want my children to grow up in a war, in a world with nuclear weapons. I got a lot more work to do. And I know you all do too, and I hope you'll continue joining us. But each of us has a different story. When I started thinking about the world that we were creating with the number of weapons we have, with the military budget we have, and I realized that it's going to be a lifetime of work. But I harken back to my faith, my own call, what I read and what I learned about what Jesus taught. And Jesus taught that we should love our enemies. Jesus taught that we should consider everyone a neighbor. So when I think about what we're trying to do with diplomacy with Iran, what are we doing? We're talking to an entity that was our enemy, and we're doing it the way that we have a construction to do it as a government. This is exactly what we should be doing. Here's the other news, of course. When we think about, so all of you guys know, we don't have these signs here today, but you all know our war is not the answer sign from 12 years ago when we went to war with Iraq.
Yes.
So the fact is, we have the answers, right? Diplomacy is an answer. Peace building is an answer. These are the things that we can do as citizens. It's the things our government can do to end war and to pivot to peace. This is what we must do now. We have to turn our attention. Like the last speaker said, there is an opening. The fact is, it is work. We are going to keep working beyond this vigil today. We're going to keep working next week against these bad bills. We're going to keep working beyond the stopping Iran's nuclear program, because diplomacy is lifelong work. The other message that I think we all know and we all share, that there is no peace without justice.
Yes.
And this is the other significant work that those of us who care about a better world and are willing to work for a better world have to do. So I thank you for this work that got us to this point today, and I thank you for the work that you're going to be doing in the future. Thanks to Move On for helping lead us today on this.
Yes, justice! Yes, peace!
Yes, justice! Yes, peace! Yes, justice! Yes, peace!
Yes, justice! Yes, peace!
Thank you. All right. So just a couple months ago, those of us who were working on this issue felt like we were in kind of a small bubble, because most of the country had no idea that this deal was possible or coming, or that a war might be coming, despite the work of a lot of well-funded people who've been advancing the idea of war with Iran since before Bush put Iran on the Axis of Evil list. Right after 9/11, thousands of people in Iran came out with signs and lighting candles saying, "We are America." Citizens in that country and citizens in this country thinking the same thing. But over the last couple of months, an extraordinary coalition has come together. And for me, yesterday encapsulated the beauty of that coalition, because I was in the Friends Committee on National Legislation's basement. Friends Committee, you know, has this, from the Quaker tradition, a pacifist, and I was in a room full of generals and combat veterans who had been fighting in America's wars. And all of us were agreeing and working together to avoid a war with Iran and support diplomacy. And one of the people who was there with me in that room is our next speaker, Arturo Flores, combat veteran in Iraq and Afghanistan, and a voice for peace. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Get up for Ben once again. He's doing a hell of a job out here. For the past 2 days, me and Ben, we've been knocking on Senate doors, knocking on congressional doors, talking to our political elected leaders, trying to convey the message of the impact that war has, not only as us as veterans, but on our families, on our neighbors, on the future of this country. War is not something that should be taken lightly, and war should definitely not be the first option. It is because of this that I was telling Ben that I support diplomacy, first and foremost. This deal is a clear sign that the United States and its allies have a coalition of nations that support diplomacy. I was going to come up here and I was going to talk about my experiences, but yesterday, around the evening time from talking so much about it, those demons started catching back up to me, and they resurfaced emotions that I thought had gone away. So I'm not going to do that, but I will say this. They say history repeats itself. Well, I have a message. Not today.
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 Not today. And not on our watch.
Not on our watch.
Let's give it up for everybody that's out here, everybody that spent money, everybody that spent time, because those are the real people that are out here making stuff happen.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.
We have one more speaker, Kevin Martins, the Executive Director of Peace Action.
Peace Action.
He's been in this fight, along with us, fighting for this deal. Thank you. Thank you, Kevin.
Kevin! Go, Kevin!
So I think the main message we need to take from today, but going forward, is this right here. Peace is greater than fear. Because that's all the other side has, is fear. They have no answers. They have no solutions. I couldn't help but see on the video board back there is a Looney Tunes cartoon. And I thought, is that the Republican leadership or who is that right there?
That's their response.
They have nothing. That's all they have is fear. And if I can update the great John Lennon's saying, we are saying, we are giving peace a chance.
We are giving peace a chance.
All we are saying, we are giving peace a chance.
We're giving peace a chance.
I think the last time I was in DuPont Circle for a political rally was in 2003, and it was the day the Iraq War started. Wow. There were a heck of a lot more people here, but this is a lot more fun to be here, and because never again and not on our watch is exactly what we need to be telling people. I think we need to gird ourselves for the struggles ahead. The forces of doom and rejectionism are not going to lie down. Peace Action has been working against war with Iran and for diplomacy since at least 2004. And we've sent many people to Iran who've all come back and said that they had the best hospitality that they've ever gotten anywhere in the world from Iran. Of all the groups that are here today, I want to give special thanks to a few that aren't. Particularly folks with a lot of bravery in the Jewish peace groups. J Street, Jewish Voice for Peace, Americans for Peace Now. Standing up for what's right, for what all Americans want, but also for what most Jews in America want. But particularly, I've been so honored and humbled for years to be in partnership with NIAC, the National Iranian American Council. Not only has NIAC been supportive of peace and diplomacy, they've been working against the demonization of an entire people, of an entire country. And there are things we certainly don't like about the politics and the policies of the country of Iran, but the people of Iran are not our enemies. They're our friends, and my hope that today is the start of a new possibility of friendship between the American and the Iranian people. Again, peace is greater than fear. Thank you very much.
So, to close out tonight, I'd like to invite one more person up. I'm the current Washington Director of Move On, but I'd like to invite the first ever Washington Director of Move On, someone who's been you know, at the heart and center of just about every struggle for peace and social justice in the last, you know, throughout her lifetime, a legend and a friend and an inspiration to all of us. And move on, Heather Booth.
You'll be there for the struggles. Our struggles are united. Our people are united.
That's right.
Thank you for all you've done. It's wonderful to celebrate this victory. And on with the struggle for the future. Yeah.
Thank you so much. Let's do one last. Defend diplomacy. No war with Iran.
Defend diplomacy. No war with Iran. Defend diplomacy, no war with Iran. Defend diplomacy, no war with Iran.
Thank you, everybody, for being here tonight.
Thank you.
Happy birthday, Minnie Benjamin. It's not a birthday, I understand.
Happy birthday to Minnie Benjamin.
Have a great evening.
Happy birthday to
If you're just tuning in, you're listening to Thursday's Community Watch and Comment, the On the Ground edition on 89.3 in Washington, D.C. I'm Esther Averma, and we just heard voices at a rush hour rally at DuPont Circle in Northwest D.C., sponsored by Move On. And it was a rally for those supporting the Iran nuclear deal. Thank you to our contributor, Chantel James, for reporting on that action. Well, when we come back, this month's installment of the F Word is all about the migration crisis in Europe and North America and the root of that crisis in imperialist wars, plunder, and destruction. Gerald Horn and Arturo Vizcarra will join us. Stay with us.
Time is catching up on you, oh slave driver. I know your sins, them are on. So carry we go home, bring the runner east. Well, come on a Rasta man, a Rasta no live on no capital land.
What you mean?
Carry we go home,
what you mean?
As if we settle and cease. Well, come on a Rasta man, a Rasta no live on no capital land.
I am
well, Lord America a capital land. The whole of Jamaica a capital land. A long time them want trick the Rasta man. Like them no know say that man a real African. You think me no member King Ferdinand? And Stephen Columbus have a golden plan. Them make a brown turn and end up in Caribbean. One Rasta no sight till nothing Indian.
Lord
in a plantation, and bring cross one ship load of African. Now here comes the thief in queen from England. Now she come a well and end me mother. Send ship on top a century full of separation. And after 400 years, me send a reparation. I know them want to kill me with the...
And welcome to back to Thursday's Community Watch and Comment. This is the On the Ground edition on 89.3 WPFW. I'm Esther Averam. And over the break, we heard Capture Land by Chronix. Well, for this month's installment of the F Word, this is our monthly segment where we discuss fascism and pre-fascism. We're going to talk about the migrant and refugee crisis in Europe and here in the United States. Millions of people are on the move around the world. They're escaping from the only homes they have ever known. Homes, hometowns, villages, and cities that have become literal hellholes. Now, while this global exodus is not new, this past year has seen a surge of migrants and refugees attempting to pour into Europe. The United Nations says that as of August, more than 300,000 refugees and migrants crossed the Mediterranean, exceeding the number in all of 2014, which was 219,000. But the International Organization for Migration gives an even higher number for this year, saying that more than 400,000 migrants and refugees have reached Europe by sea this year. So on the other end, this crisis has been fuel to the fire of racism, xenophobia, and very fascist rhetoric and acts here in the U.S. and in Europe. So joining me today via Skype to unpack this complex subject is the prolific author and activist Gerald Horn, professor of history and African American studies at the University of Houston, and frequent contributor to this show and across the Pacifica Network. His forthcoming book is Confronting the Black Jacobins, which is about the worldwide impact of the Haitian Revolution. Good morning, Gerald.
Good morning. Is my voice okay?
Oh, yeah, I can hear you now. Okay. Now, also joining me here in D.C. via Skype is Arturo Vizcarra, Advocacy Coordinator for School of America's Watch, an independent organization that seeks to close the Georgia-based U.S. Army School of the Americas under whatever name it's called now. And they accomplish this through vigils and fasts, demonstrations and nonviolent protests, as well as media and legislative work. Graduates of the School of America, which has been renamed but not really changed, have included some of the worst and most notorious human rights abuses in Latin American history. And for much of the world, the school, under any name, is synonymous with torture and impunity. Good morning, Arturo.
Good morning.
So, thank you both for joining me. And actually, in the studio is our contributor, our intern, Chantal James, who attended an immigration forum at American University yesterday. And Chantal is a Fulbright scholar and a graduate student in philosophy at American University. She's the author of two novels and a contributing writer to Paste Magazine and to MTV Iggy. So welcome, Chantal.
Thank you.
Okay, so it's really difficult to know where to begin on this topic, Gerald and Arturo. So rather than start with either Europe or North America, I thought I'd maybe start with an idea and have you both comment on that first. And the idea is that almost all of the coverage of what is happening with people coming to the United States or to Europe misses the point of how the U.S. and Western Europe have created these intolerable conditions in these countries where people are fleeing. So I want you to both offer your reaction to the migrant narrative that is dominant in the corporate media. So I thought I'd start in this hemisphere with you, Arturo, and then Gerald, you can talk about migrants streaming into Europe. Arturo?
Well, yes, as you say, I can't really explain it, but I do think it's very clear there's some sort of cognitive dissonance. Mass cognitive dissonance when you discuss migration from Latin America to the U.S. In the sense of, as a Salvadoran, it doesn't make me proud to say this, but the U.S. has much more influence in Central America and Mexico, but especially in Central America, small client states for hundreds of years. The U.S. has been dictating economic security and all other types of policies in these countries for such a long time. So no matter what, without even getting into the specifics of what the U.S. has been doing over in these countries over the last couple of years or decades or more recently, just that fact of that history shows that the U.S. has, they bear responsibility for the conditions that are occurring there, given the fact that they are the ones that control the outcomes, the political outcomes, the economic policies, the security policies. And then when you actually go into the more of the details of what are those policies, you can see from, for example, from the 80s, funding the dirty wars down in Central America, that causing mass migration. Then again, right now with the drug war, and all the neoliberal economic policies that the U.S. pushes, the so-called Washington Consensus. And these countries have followed those dictates, and yet the results of following the dictates of Washington have produced chaos, destruction, misery, suffering, death, and it's ridiculous to... I really don't understand how people, I guess it's just that people are ignorant of the history, ignorant of what's actually going on, but even people, when they do realize some of that stuff, they're still very afraid to put the blame on the U.S., and I would put some blame on immigrant rights organizations for that as well.
Now, I know, Arturo, that your family actually had to flee El Salvador during the country's civil war, and I hope that we can get back to that, but you have your own living testimony to how the U.S. has impacted Central and South America certainly in your lifetime as well. So,
yes.
So Gerald, how about Europe? Yesterday, Hungarian troops clashed with migrants at the Hungarian-Serbian border, and Hungarian's leader, Viktor Orban, has begun to utilize this rhetoric of Christian nationalism to oppose immigration from Africa and the Arabian Peninsula. We know in Germany there have been attacks on immigrants and really swelling anti-immigrant movement spearheaded by the racist Pegida Party. So what about what's happening in Europe?
Well, the point that you make about the North Atlantic countries being largely responsible for this crisis that has beset Europe was also a point made by President Jacob Zuma of South Africa speaking to the diplomatic corps in South Africa just yesterday. Now, of course, he was referring to Libya and how Libya has become a gateway for those seeking to cross the Mediterranean into Greece and Italy in particular. Of course, he did not apologize for the fact that South Africa has some complicity since it signed on to the misadventure in 2011 led by the North Atlantic Treaty Organizations in the United States, Britain, and France that led to the overthrow of the Gaddafi regime and has turned Libya into a charnel house, into a place of chaos and riotous anarchy that has opened the gates for people from other parts of Africa fleeing across the Mediterranean. He could have also gone on to talk about U.S. policy in Syria, which is wholly incoherent insofar as the fact that supposedly the United States is trying to destabilize the so-called Islamic State, but at the same time, it's battling tooth and nail and trying to overthrow the most resolute anti-ISIS force. I'm speaking of the President al-Assad regime in Damascus. Of course, he could have also mentioned U.S. policy with regard to Iraq and the 2003 invasion of that country, wholly illegal by U.S. President George W. Bush, which not only has created a refugee crisis, which you've made reference to, but also helped to give rise and give birth to ISIS itself. I should also mention that there is an ongoing scandal in Washington that your listeners should pay very careful and close attention to. And that is the idea that U.S. intelligence analysts have been primed to soft pedal the rise of ISIS, to downplay the rise of ISIS, which in many ways is the reverse mirror image of what happened during the Bush administration, when the Bush administration, of course, hyped the alleged allegation that the Saddam Hussein regime supposedly had weapons of mass destruction, which prepared the way for the misadventure in Iraq. Now they're downplaying the results of that. And of course, this could really blow up in the administration's face. But we should also pay close attention to these regimes in Eastern Europe, particularly Hungary, not least since we all know, those of us who have a historical memory, that there was a celebration when these anti-communist right-wing forces came to power some years ago, and supposedly this meant a new birth of freedom. But now the ugly truth is emerging that these are neo-fascist forces, as your F-word series tends to suggest, and that they're giving succor and sustenance to like-minded forces in France with the National Front, in Germany with the so-called Alternative for Deutschland, and throughout Western Europe. It's a very dangerous turn of events, I might add.
Dread and terror pandemic. Who's got a face that will? I have his mercy.
Hello, my name is David Levine, and I'm the 2015 WPFW Local Election Supervisor. The following are messages from candidates for the upcoming 2015 WPFW Local Station Board election. To view their full statements, visit elections.pacifica.org. Thank you.
Hello, my name is Sabu Hakim, and I am running for a seat on the Local Station Board at WPFW. A friend who is familiar with my work in the community suggested that I bring my experience to WPFW as another way to serve the community. I believe that I can make a difference with my experience with community fundraising and event planning. I have sponsored fundraisers with my community civic association from North Michigan Park and served as the chair of the North Michigan Park Scholarship Fundraising Committee for several years. In 1977, I helped establish the Morgan State University radio station along with two others, hosted a magazine show that shared information regarding science, food, and world news. Thank you for considering me as a candidate for the Local Station Board.
All public broadcast stations receiving funds from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, or CPB, are required by law to have a Community Advisory Board, or CAB. The function of WPFW's CAB is to review the station's programming goals, the services provided by the station, and any significant policy decisions made by the station, and to serve as a vehicle for the community to effectively provide input to the local station board. To that end, the community is invited to offer feedback in any of these areas by emailing the CAB at cab.wpfw@mail.com. That's cab.wpfw@mail.com. WPFW, serving 100% of the 99.
Dread and terror pandemic. Who's God of grace and will? I have his mercy.
And welcome back to On the Ground. This is Esther Rivera, and I'm speaking to Arturo Vizcarra and Gerald Horn and Chantel James here in the studio. Gerald, you talked about this current scandal brewing about basically intel being used to misinform people, this misinformation campaign, as far as that's how I would characterize it anyway. And that kind of reminds me about some of the really ignorant rhetoric of someone like Donald Trump or other individuals and groups in Europe and here, like that you're hearing on the presidential campaign. And Arturo, I want to get you to respond to a couple of clips that we're going to play of Donald Trump making comments about immigrants on the campaign trail.
When Mexico sends its people, they're not sending their best. They're not sending you. They're not sending you. They're sending people that have lots of problems, and they're bringing those problems with us. They're bringing drugs, they're bringing crime, they're rapists, and some, I assume, are good people.
So that was in his announcement for the presidency, for his campaign. How did you react to that, and what kind of impact did that have across the immigrant community and maybe even outside this country?
Yeah, well, I was actually in Mexico when Trump made those comments, and it definitely resonated very strongly there as well. I was in the news throughout my entire almost 4-week stay in Mexico. He became a big topic. Obviously, just, you know, I hadn't heard or listened to that in a while. And obviously the tone in almost every word is deeply offensive. And just the signal, like, they're not, you know, focusing on that part when he says they're not bringing you, it's just obviously positioning, saying that quote unquote Americans, people from the U.S., which is usually means white Americans, are superior and are better than the people that are coming here, and I think it's just highly offensive when we actually, and you know, he goes on to say about how Mexico owes the U.S. Well, I would say that the U.S. owes reparations to all of the people of Mexico and Central America and other parts of Latin America for the state terrorism that they've supported, for NAFTA, for CAFTA, for the exploitative free trade agreements that have forced so many migrants from Central America to come. I mean, here, the U.S. continues at the WTO to insist on maintaining its huge agricultural subsidies. Well, that's the primary reason why there was so much Mexican immigration, was because of those agricultural subsidies, then pricing Mexican farmers out after NAFTA, and they continue to come as economic refugees. Now we have people coming because they are war refugees, or just refugees. Mm-hmm. They are fleeing the drug war. Yes, many of them are poor. They're not the vast majority of people coming. You know, it's been proven immigrants have there's a lower crime rate in immigrant communities than there are in the rest of U.S. society. It's not, but it's not about trying to finger point and say who's criminal. You know, what kind of criminal activity it is, but it's obviously utilizing you know, specific cases, like it was the case of the San Francisco shooting in San Francisco as one incident, and trying to use that to
paint millions of
people in a negative light.
Right, and you're referring to the situation where a man, I think, attacked a woman. He may have stabbed her or shot her or something, and it turned out that he was undocumented, right?
Right. Yeah. It was still unclear exactly what happened, and it was like supposedly even the gun of a federal. I don't stop following the story, but obviously it was utilized to support. It was blown out of proportion. Okay. Precisely by Trump.
All right. So we have such a little bit of time, but I want to make sure that I at least mention, so people can look it up themselves. There's an article in Alternet, 10 Times White Nationalists Supported Donald Trump and Why This Should Scare You. That's the title of it, and I want you to check that out. And there's also another article that by Joe Connison that says, is Donald Trump really a fascist? And these are recent articles on Alternet. You can check those out, and they will have a lot of really interesting information in terms of reshaping the narrative and allowing us to look at what's really happening and not kind of this misinformation campaign. So with that in mind, I want to switch to you, Chantal. You went to a forum yesterday at American University on immigration, and what was the main takeaway from that conference? Were they talking about these issues, or were they just talking about it in the more of a policy lens?
Well, they weren't really talking about the way immigrants are perceived in the media or by politicians or anything like that. They're mostly talking about the crisis in El Salvador. There's a violent gang crisis there, and they're talking about how that has pushed migrants to the United States.
Oh, okay. Yeah, and I actually saw a report. A photographer went inside a prison in El Salvador where the guards actually don't like patrol the prison. They just kind of like make sure no one leaves. And so the prisoners basically run the prison, and I guess there's some, you know, serious gang members there. But okay, so hopefully we can play a lot of the sound from that forum next week.
Okay.
Okay, and I thank you again for covering that.
Mm-hmm.
So Gerald, a lot of the recent concern for the migrant issue in Europe was brought about by the death of a small Syrian boy who drowned as his family was trying to cross the Mediterranean. And there have been calls for more nations to vow to take in more Syrian refugees. But, you know, two things happened. I heard an interview with Africans in a migrant camp on the border between France and the UK in France, wanting to get into the UK, saying that, hey, we're already here. Why are there no calls to take us in to make a place for us? And there was another report about one of these many trans-Mediterranean voyages where black people, black Africans, were put on the lower deck so that the ship might have a better chance of being allowed to land or be rescued. So the idea that the lighter-skinned people would draw more sympathy. And, of course, many of those on the bottom would be more likely to drown. So I want you to talk about the racial dynamics of this crisis in Europe.
Well, certainly there has been the persistent allegation that this switch in Europe to much more sympathy for the incoming flow of refugees is connected to the fact that this incoming flow is coming from Syria in particular, and not, for example, from Eritrea, where many refugees have left in recent months, or not coming from West Africa. As you correctly suggest, in Calais, in France, there has been a persistent and nagging crisis with regard to Africans who are gathering there, trying to get across the English Channel into London, because many of them are English speakers. They have been brutalized. They have been subjected to a very pernicious kind of bigotry, and yet it has not gathered headlines. I doubt if this is only because there has not been an affecting image of an African toddler washed up on a beach. As your question suggests, I think this has a lot to do with an anti-African bias which has characterized Western Europe and indeed the North Atlantic nations for hundreds of years.
I was also wondering if you know, as a bridge between talking about Europe and the U.S., if there's, if any of the research for your upcoming book on the Haitian Revolution has influenced your thinking on this topic, you know, which is just one end game of sorts for this history, longer history of colonialism, imperialism, and the empire of white supremacy.
Well, one of the points that I make in this book that you so kindly mention is that you cannot begin to understand the abolition of slavery nor the retreat of white supremacy that that abolition represented without understanding the fact that the Africans in Hispaniola, particularly Haiti, rose up as one and kicked out the French colonialists along with a number of U.S. nationals, I might add. There is a contemporary historian whose name I will not mention who suggests that what happened to Europeans in Hispaniola at the beginning of the 19th century was actually an early example of genocide. I think that that's a bridge too far, but it does give you an idea of the kind of hysteria that has gripped African-European relations for hundreds of years, and I dare say still characterizes the relationship between these two groups.
Okay. We are so quickly running out of time, but Arturo, I wanted to give you a chance to talk about your the upcoming one-year anniversary of the disappearance of the 43 students from Ayotzinapa in Mexico, and, you know, what are the links for you between this migrant crisis and the state, that state violence that's occurring in Mexico?
Well, yeah, thank you for mentioning that. I think the drug war right now has provided cover for this Mexican state to suppress and kill its own citizens. And I think we see with specifically with these 43 students, these are 43 people that were activists. They were leftist students, and that's part of the reason why they were targeted by the state. The fact that it's actually unproven whether there was any criminal, quote-unquote criminal organizations involved, any drug cartels in the disappearances of the students. But what is very clear is that the Mexican police, local police, municipal police, and military was on the scene. And that's just, it's just one example of the type of violence. Mexican migration is kind of, in general, is a net zero, but fear-based migration has been steadily increasing during this drug war.
Okay.
Because it's a narco state, basically, that we're funding a narco state that's just in line with the drug cartels that's supposedly being fought. So,
okay. I'm sorry, we're going to have to cut it off there. I want to thank my guests, Arturo Vizcarra and Gerald Horn. Thank you both for joining me today.
Thank you.
And that will do it for us on Thursday's Community Watch and Comment, the On the Ground edition. I'm Esther Rivera, and I want to thank my guests again, Professor Gerald Horn and activist and attorney Arturo Vizcarra. I want to thank Chantel James for her reporting at DuPont Circle and Brianna Rawlinson for her reporting last night at the End the Cuba Blockade Action. And thanks to our engineer, Michael Nasella. And thank you so much for listening and supporting your station for jazz and justice. You can reach the show at onthegroundshow.org, where you can now listen to all of our shows and past shows. Please like our Facebook and Twitter pages at On the Ground Show. Now stay tuned for the news, followed by Krista Property on the Thursday edition of Don't Forget the Blues. Raise your voice. Peace. I'm